From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. It's nice to have you along. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. We'll start our week in review with a little debate about trigger warnings. We've seen more college professors offering trigger warnings for selected readings and videos, particularly if the selections include sexual violence. But it can be controversial.
Yeah, in this clip, RIT lecturer Karen Van Meenen explains why she generally does not offer trigger warnings. Longtime Hobart professor Les Friedman weighs in, and then graduate student and playwright Catherine Varga, who has a different view of trigger warnings.
Trigger warnings are a relatively new thing in my experience. And I had a recent experience. I run the Creative Writing Awards for the department, and there was a student who won an award and was reading a story that had a scene of sexual assault. And on top of that, she wasn't able to come, so she had sent me an audio. So there wasn't a person standing there where we could reflect on their own experience or watch their face or their body language. It was just a disembodied audio. And I was a little concerned about that. To people coming to an award ceremony, and I checked with our Title IX coordinator, and I gave a little trigger warning, and that felt like the right thing to do. It doesn't come up so much in the classroom.
Okay.
If I were to teach Lolita, for example, which is highly problematic in many ways, that would be something that I would attend to. It is something of concern, and this really, I'm hesitating because this is that gray area where the snowflake, you know, comes into play is, you know, I remember at one point there, I think it was post-Trump's election, there was a university who created a safe space for students if they needed just to isolate themselves. And that was guffawed from many camps, that you just have to buck up, the world is tough, and you're not going to always see what's coming at you.
How do you respond to the critics who say that any trigger warning is soft, catering, it's placating students who are not doing a good job of handling a difficult world?
I guess I will out myself here and say I do fall more in that camp, partly because I know in my own classroom I have the skills and education and training. I actually have a degree in counseling psychology that helps me in the classroom to manage difficult situations or students who become emotional or have a more profound reaction. But as I said about the award ceremony, that was a more public space. So I thought it engendered a different kind of response.
Les?
Well, I have had this happen. I try to deal with it in several ways. First of all, when I'm going over the syllabus on the first day, I give the equivalent of PG-13R warnings. But I don't think you can avoid these emotional situations, as you have had. I've had students respond to sexual assault. I've had students respond to the death of a parent in a piece of literature when her father had just died. And yes, I suppose I fall into this category as well. If a student says to me, I can't watch that, sometimes I say, I've seen it already, and I know I can't watch it. I don't make them watch it. I think that would be cruel and unusual punishment. Now, I must say, after I've said that, I mean, I've taught for a lot of decades. That's very rare that a student says that to me. So when a student says that to me, I feel I have to honor that.
Let me ask Catherine and Jamie how they feel about trigger warnings and whether it's reasonable to make those requests, and should professors honor them?
I actually have an anecdote that flips it. I teach playwriting at Ohio University, and one of my students actually put a trigger warning on her play. So I think trigger warnings are just kind of a courtesy, part of the culture, and it's not always professors giving trigger warnings on students. Sometimes it's students to each other saying, like, here's a heads up, my play deals with challenging issues, I just wanted to let you know in case that's going to be a problem. And I see it as just courtesy.
Do you think professors should offer the same courtesy?
Yes, I do.
Okay, before I get Jamie's thought, you generally disagreed with that, Karen.
Well,
so where's the
I also have a line on my syllabus that talks about there are difficult situations in life and the classroom.
Sure.
And if you have any issues now or in the future, please come to me immediately. And I've had a couple of students who have come to me saying, I want to share this thing, mostly in writing classes. I want to share this thing, but I'm not sure if it's appropriate. And in both cases, I said, yes, we'll have a little trigger warning. But in general, I don't agree that if I bring a piece of literature to the table that I have worked with and vetted and I feel comfortable, working in the classroom with that I need a trigger warning in general.
A trigger warning, that makes it sound really intense.
It does.
I think of it as like a heads up, like so you know, this has some issues. And it takes 2 seconds. It can be a very easy way of just giving people context for what they're about to see. I see it as not a very hot topic thing to do. It just seems...
You think this is overblown?
Yeah.
The controversy? Because I think the critics of the controversy believe that when students are given these warnings, that's a green light for them to say, well, then I'm just not going to read this book, or I'm not going to engage in the lesson. Is that a green light for students to opt out?
As a student, I don't think so. I wouldn't take it that way, and I have not seen it taken that way in classrooms I've been a part of. So.
I agree. I haven't seen it take that way, but I do think there's a difference between a trigger warning about an emotional thing and exposing them to something that's unpleasant and that they disagree with. I mean, I think they should be exposed to things they don't disagree with that may be unpleasant. But that seems to me apples and oranges with this kind of emotional minefields for students.
Okay. Jamie, how do you feel about it?
No, so yeah, I agree with what Catherine is saying, where it doesn't take long to just give people a heads up. And to that idea that it's catering to people who can't handle a difficult world, well, the world is more difficult for some people than it is for others, and some people are more equipped to deal with those difficulties. So I think just giving someone a heads up is the least you can do to just recognize that.
Let's turn to one of the truly gripping conversations we've had this year on the talk show. Helen Levinson is an 88-year-old Holocaust survivor. The JCC in Rochester is getting ready to tell her story. Next week, the JCC debuts a play called Survivors, featuring the story of 10 Holocaust survivors.
We had the chance to speak with Helen about her life and how she escaped the Nazis. Here she is explaining her thoughts about the corrosive power of hate.
I have spoken to many, many classes. There are thousands of children. And I'm talking mainly about hatred, how very, very terrible hatred is. And I want the children to know what happens when you hate. And I want, like I many times say when I start to talk, that I wish that we could just take that word out of the dictionary, cross it out altogether. Because hatred is a terrible disease. Actually, when you hate, you hurt more yourself than the other people. You just don't feel right to hate somebody. Like in Poland, for example, there were some Polish people who would give away, even though they were Poles themselves, Christians themselves, if a Christian Pole hit a Jew, they would gladly go to a Gestapo man and point out where the Jew was hiding, and they knew that not only the Jew was going to be killed, but the whole Christian family. How can you be a Christian and do that? I always wondered about that, but there were some Poles who were so full of hatred that they gladly did that. The country is now with young kids who don't even know what the Nazis were. I feel that they're different people now. They're not the Nazis that we knew. I would not be able to get across a person that called themselves Nazi, because the Nazis that I knew were heartless people. They were horrible people. I would say even a beast has more feeling than the Nazis had. That's what I would say. Horrible, horrible people. And they were ingrained. They were full of hatred. And they could do whatever they wanted to do with human beings. And many times it wasn't very pretty to see what they did with them.
Helen, but do you have any fear that there is a modern resurgence of Nazism?
I do have fear, and that's why I'm talking, because I hear about hatred in Europe, and sometimes I even feel that some of it is gone over to this country. Some of it is not very pretty, but that's the reason I keep on talking. I'm going to be talking until the day I die, because I want the children to realize how terrible hatred is, that it can happen to anyone, anyone. You can hate the Christian religion just like you hated the Jewish religion, and you can hate black people just like you hated the Jews. Hatred is just all over. You've got to warn yourself. I always tell the children, if you join a group and you see that they are talking about hatred, immediately drop out of it. Don't go to a group that says hatred, because that's the worst thing in the world you could do.
Next, we all know someone living with Alzheimer's or dementia. There's a growing body of research demonstrating the power of music in sparking parts of the brain that have long gone quiet. A new documentary called Alive Inside explores this phenomenon.
In this clip, you're going to hear part of the film in which a woman with dementia experiences the power of music. And then you'll hear Brian LeBlanc, who joins us by phone from his home in Florida. He was diagnosed with Alzheimer's before even turning 50, and he now hosts a video series about living well with dementia and Alzheimer's.
How old are you?
How old am I?
Yeah.
I'm 90 years old.
What was life like when you were a little girl?
God, I've forgotten so much. I've forgotten so much. I'm very sorry. I've been here 90 years. And if I could remember, I would tell you, but I can't remember.
I want you to try and let the music take you back into your memories, to travel back into time. And then we'll stop. And you can tell me where it took you. You ready?
That's Louis Armstrong. Wow. Oh, he's singing "When the Saints Go By, Marching By," and it takes me back to my school days.
I would like to hit the number.
Mama told us not to go listen to him. We would sneak off at night, bring back pictures from the dance. And I worked in Kings County 9 years, the E building in Kings County. My birthday, November 20th, 19. I was in the wartime. I was working at Fort Jackson. And my son, on February the 4th, was 69. I didn't know I could talk so much.
I spent my first 30 years in New Orleans, okay, when I started, and I'm a huge Saints fan. So I hear the song "When the Saints Come Marching In." I know y'all were thinking about the movie and what the lady's reaction was, because I saw that movie. And I'm sitting here recollecting all these thoughts as clear as day of what happened, you know, way back when I first started hearing that music and Louis Armstrong and just the whole growing up period in New Orleans. So I was experiencing my musical therapy in real time, you know, just as I was hearing the music. So it's a wonderful thing. I mentioned that my mother passed away with Alzheimer's back in 2015, and that was only 3 months after I received my diagnosis. I live in Pensacola, Florida, and my family lives in New Orleans. So, but my sister, she said, you know, look, you don't need to see Mom right now in the condition that she's in. She can't communicate. We just need to make her happy and make her comfortable. She said, but everybody else has been here to tell her goodbye. She said, but she seems to be holding on for something. So she says, I'm going to put you on speakerphone. I want you to talk to her. So I said, okay. Well, as a side note, my mother sang in church for 40 years. I sang in church for over 40 years. So I couldn't think of anything better to do than to sing her one of the hymns that was one of my favorites and one of the ones that she remembered. Well, when I started talking to her, her eyes started moving underneath her eyelids. And my sister told me, she goes, she has not shown any activity in days. She said, now her eyes are moving back and forth. They didn't open, but they were, you know, they were moving. And she said, I think she hears you. Keep on talking. So I did. And then without telling my sister, I just started singing a hymn by the name of Be Not Afraid. And it talks about, you know, be not afraid, I go before you always. Come follow me, and, you know, so forth. And it was wonderful. And her eyes were just going back and forth and back and forth. And not long after that, she passed away. And so from what I understand, and I'm not a medical professional, but I understand that the hearing is one of the last things to go. Even if you're in a state that looks like you're not there, like in a comatose state of mind. But I'm going to forever believe that she heard me. And I'm going to make sure that, you know, in my last days, that music is going to be playing for me, you know, when I'm leaving this earth.
We're going to close this week with the great John Cleese, one of the founders of the famous Monty Python comedy troupe. Cleese is coming to Rochester next month for a special showing of Monty Python and the Holy Grail, followed by an extended Q&A with John Cleese. He loves engaging with audiences on just about anything, which is exactly what he did with us on the talk show this week.
Cleese called Connections from London, and in this clip, you'll hear Evan ask him about his remarks on Twitter that expressed frustration with recent elections and politics.
You wrote, quote, "I think there are a lot of decent people in the UK who have no idea how corrupt we have become," end quote. And certainly some Americans might feel that way. Do you have a sense of how we arrived at this moment when so many citizens are almost gleeful about corruption, whether it's in the UK or here, as long as it serves the end goal, which is just to spite the ideological opposition?
Oh, dear, this is such a vast subject. I think what I feel is this, that a lot of organized religion was rubbish. But not everything in religion was rubbish, but a lot of it was rubbish. I mean, I remember writing a line years ago, we fetched a character called Vice Pope Eric, and he was talking about Christ's teaching, and he said, you know, when you're trying to propagate a teaching of humility and poverty and tolerance, you need a very rich, powerful, authoritarian organization to do it. Now, I think that's a very good joke. Here you have the Catholic Church, which is very rich, very powerful, and very authoritarian, trying to teach what Christ taught, what Christ was trying to teach. If you read the Beatitudes, all that stuff about blessed are the poor in spirit, that's about getting trying to reduce the power of your ego, you know? It has that in common with Buddhism. Any proper religion is about trying to reduce the power of our egos. And yet, this religion is in the hands of a group of people, an organized church, which is behaving entirely egotistically because it's trying to become bigger and powerful and richer. So it's an inborn contradiction. But I think that as religion has slowly collapsed in most parts of the world, there's been a vacuum of values. And when that happens, people always turn to money. And if there is one doctrine that is causing more problems than anything else in the world, I think it's this. It's people who say that it's a moral duty to increase one's bottom line as far as one can, to make as much money as possible is a moral duty. And once you've got to that, I think the civilization collapses. Mm.
John Cleese, my guest, and I've got probably time for one more question before we offend you and take too much of your time, John. So I'm panicked. I'm looking at my long list of questions, and I realized I'm just going to have to see you on July 27th in Rochester.
Ask me the date of a battle. Then ask me the date of any battle in history, and I'll tell you.
I'm not going to waste your time with that, but I'm going to get back to why you're coming to Rochester, which is Monty Python and the Holy Grail. You know, I was going to ask you how improvised the Frenchman on top of the castle scenes were, but I'll wait till you're here in Rochester for that. I will ask you this.
No, I'll tell you, none of it was improvised.
None of it.
Seriously, we were six writers who happened to perform our own material. It was all about what was on the page,
okay,
the script.
All right, very good. And I wanted to ask you about, you know, is in terms of scene writing, Monty Python is, you know, at the very, very top for me in terms of scene writing. But we already talked before you joined the program this hour about the argument, which happens to have an ending in which you poke fun at your own group's occasional struggles to find the right ending for a scene. You joked in that sketch about how you often bring the police in to call the scene to an end, which is exactly what you did in Monty Python and the Holy Grail. And I wanted to ask you how difficult it is to end a scene. How difficult and how important is it to end a scene? And do you look back and wish you had done any of that differently?
No, because what we found was that some scenes do have a natural ending, and others don't. And we used to spend hours trying to find a really good ending when there actually wasn't one out there. And so what we used to do is, you know, we used to just abandon sketches in the middle after Anne Chapman come in and say, this is getting too silly. And that way, if the sketch did have a good ending, we kept it. But otherwise, we didn't waste a lot of time on trying to find an ending that wasn't actually there. So I think that was one of the smartest things we did.
And as you look back at Holy Grail, I don't know how else you would have ended that, but you're happy with the close of Holy Grail?
Well, the ending is terrible. We get away with it. I mean, people say, why'd you end it like that? The answer is, it was the best we could think of.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon on WXXI AM 1370. On WRUR 88.5 FM and on WEOS, Finger Lakes Public Radio, that's 89.5 FM.
We are also on the WXXI mobile app. Have a great weekend, everyone. He's Evan. I'm Megan. We'll talk to you Monday.